Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Michael Eric Dyson, one of America's premier public intellectuals, who was University Professor of Sociology at Georgetown University and the author of the new book, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. He joins us to discuss the continuing racist obsession with Barack Obama that President Trump, the Republicans, Fox News, and white nationalist America cannot let go of, even after Obama has left office, and perhaps the most right-wing government in the nation's history is now in power. We will look into why Trump blames Obama for all of his problems when the White House and Trump's cabinet is largely made up of rich white men and surrogates for rich white men who have a friendly Republican House and Senate to work with. We'll also try to make sense of Dr. Ben Carson's remarks he made as the new head of housing and urban development to the HUD employees, where he said that, quote, slaves who came in the bottom of slave ships and worked even longer, even harder for less, were immigrants who aspired to the American dream. Then we'll examine the latest WikiLeaks data dump of CIA cyber tools that has been likened in scope to the Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden caches of secret documents made public by the anti-secrecy website. Alan Paller, the director of research at the SANS Institute, the principal cybersecurity training school that produces the annual Greatest Risks in Cybersecurity study, joins us to discuss whether these some 8,000 web pages with 943 attachments are a serious blow to the CIA and its own Center for Cyber Intelligence. Then finally, we'll assess the American Health Care Act, the House Republican plan to repeal and replace Obamacare that was announced today to criticism coming mostly from Republicans, some of whom thought it went too far and others who thought it did not go far enough in killing the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's signature achievement. A leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform, Jonathan Oberlander, a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, joins us to look into this new plan that is about to be rushed through Congress before its numbers are crunched. And joining us now is Michael Eric Dyson, one of America's premier public intellectuals. He occupies the distinguished position of University Professor of Sociology at Georgetown University and is a contributing opinion writer to the New York Times and a contributing editor to the New Republic and ESPN's Undefeated. Ebony Magazine named him one of 100 most influential African Americans in the nation, and his latest book just out is Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Eric Dyson.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. And in terms of my opening premise, I'm struck by what appears to be an obsession that President Trump simply can't get rid of. He first identified himself politically as the leader of the Bertha movement to delegitimize President Obama as an American. And then, throughout the campaign, he was disrespectful in ways, not that there hasn't been a lot of disrespect shown to President Obama from the Republicans throughout his 8 years in office, but he was extremely disrespectful. And now he's being even more disrespectful than ever in his most latest attack tweets, calling Obama a bad, sick guy. So my real question is, you would think that having got to the presidency, having achieved the office, the most powerful office in the land, that Trump would let it go. But it seems like he's bashing Obama more than ever and blaming him for everything that's gone wrong.
Exactly right. He is pretty obsessed with Obama. The boogeyman, the collective black presence, the shadow, that will not let him go. And he is obsessed with Obama to the point that he is evoking his name to blame him for everything that's going wrong as a distraction to the American people to suggest that he is the ominous, threatening person that he made him out to be. So the birther attacks were not successful. So now he's trying to blame him for other things. He's trying to blame him for, spying on him. He's trying to blame him for having, something that George Bush did that Barack Obama didn't do. So anything to use him as an all-purpose, all-utility boogeyman to continue to get as much mileage and political capital out of demonizing the black guy, the black president. And it plays on ominous racial undertones that are quite distressing. And the reality is that he continues to engage in conversation and engage in the kind of attacks that bespeak a level of assault upon the president that, diminishes his own office and continues to, in a very serious sense, diminish his stature as a president. It reinforces the belief that Donald Trump is truly a toddler president, a guy who says whatever is on his mind. He excretes feces of rhetoric into that diaper and tweets them to the world, and they are pretty malodorous, and they are pretty, and I'm sorry to sustain that metaphor, but they are pretty repulsive in the sense that the racial undertones with putting Steve Bannon in office, with putting Sessions as the attorney general, has only reinforced the perception that this is a racially insensitive president who is only amplifying and echoing the worst sentiments possible to the American people.
But you would think, though, Michael Eric Dyson, that the subtext always was for Obama from white racist America was their obsession with him, I think, was it a kind of terrible fear that this black guy was very, very clever, presentable, decent, intelligent, engaging, and it drove them crazy that he did a good job, or at least tried to do a good job, and they did everything they could in their toolkit of mendacity to prevent his presidency. Remember, the day of his inauguration, Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, Newt Gingrich, right, and a bunch of Republicans got together the very day of Obama's initial inauguration and plotted to destroy his presidency. So in spite of that, he still did pretty well and has left with very, very high approval ratings. So again, isn't this the moment for the white boys to show and strut their stuff and show us how much better they are?
That's exactly right. You would think so. But what this underscores is the ultimate fake news is white supremacy, white superiority, that you're better than the black guy. That's the ultimate fake news. Alternative facts have been generated out of a racial discourse and a racial paradigm and a racial mindset that was set 200 years ago. The very moment that black people were brought to America as subordinate to Americans who are white, the mythology and the fake news of their superiority went forth. Donald Trump is the living proof that no matter how much you insist upon it, it is not an argument. No matter how much you assert it, it is not a serious, engaged, and sustained conversation with the facts or truth. And so now he is left with the fact that he is, manifestly inferior, both intellectually and certainly rhetorically, and he hasn't been able to master the mechanics of the presidency because he has never held public office before or political office. So the reality is that, yeah, this is the time for the white boy to show that the black boy wasn't as good as he is, but it was always a myth, it was always a fiction, it was always a contrivance, and therefore what we're seeing now is that all of this fake news that he seems to rail against, that is President Trump, and all of the mythologies he thinks are being generated, and the lies being told and the mendacity being spread, he thinks is being deployed against him when he is at the epicenter of such mendacity. And the mendaciousness is rooted in the very whiteness that he is incapable of separating himself from. And as a result of that, he's the perfect face of white innocence, white fragility, and the convergence with white power at the same time. So now, yeah, the reason he's obsessed with Obama is that he's not been able to prove yet that he can overtake him, that he can outdo him. So the best thing is to undercut him.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Eric Dyson, one of America's premier public intellectuals. He occupies the distinguished position of University Professor of Sociology at Georgetown University and is a contributing opinion writer to the New York Times, a contributing editor to the New Republic and ESPN's Undefeated, and Ebony Magazine named him one of the 100 most influential African Americans in the nation. His latest book just out is Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. And you, of course, are a Baptist preacher, and in many ways your new book is an effort to tell white America, it's a sermon to white America, that if we want true racial equality in America, whites themselves must destroy the enduring myths of white supremacy. Now,
right.
Ironically, do you is Donald Trump going to do that?
Well, you know, what he's doing willy-nilly is dismantling that mythology. He's not attempting to do so. He's attempting to assert the primacy of white intelligence, and what he's doing and exposing to us is that he is as loony and as fringe a figure who's ever occupied that office, and he's doing nothing to deconstruct the fictions and mythologies of whiteness, and he's not challenging it at its core because he is the manifestation of its blindness, its willful resistance to acknowledgement that it even exists. And so Donald Trump, again, is the perfect, if you will, face of that white fragility, that white power, and he's constantly talking about, oh, I don't want to be politically incorrect, you know, politically correct. I want to be politically incorrect, by which most white men mean in his position that I want to be able to go along unabated with my racial intolerance and my racial bigotry without being caught on it, because the flip side cannot be taken or tolerated. That is to say, if you want to be politically incorrect, when the truth comes at you unvarnished, spoken directly to you, can you, as a white man, understand and accept the criticisms and critiques that can be leveled your way? Of course not. He's one of the most thin-skinned, intolerant, reactive presidents we've ever seen, and barely capable of refraining from saying exactly what's on his mind. No deferred gratification, no ability to be self-disciplined, no ability to not say everything that comes to mind. And furthermore, the inability to play well with others in the sandbox of life. It's my way or the highway. He punishes people. He disdains those who challenge his authority, who express dissent. And it's a wonder that James Comey is still in office. And if it is true that he said that he wanted the Department of Justice to publicly repudiate the White House for suggesting, and Donald Trump in particular, that Barack Obama, in particular, not the Obama administration, but Barack Obama, tapped his wiretapped his phones, it may be that he's not long for this world of politics, that is James Comey, as the director of the FBI. This is the kind of figure we're dealing with in a Donald Trump. And when you add in paranoia and egotism and narcissism, it's a lethal combination.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Michael Eric Dyson, I mentioned in the opening the extraordinary remark by Dr. Ben Carson in front of the employees of HUD the other day, where he said slaves who came in the bottom of slave ships and worked even longer, even harder for less, were in effect immigrants who aspired to the American dream. And of course, the American dream itself came during the Aussie and Harriet Halcyon days, which are the very things that Ronald Reagan harked back to, take America back as the refrain, and of course, Donald Trump's theme is Make America Great Again. And this is an atavistic idea to go back to an America when blacks and Latinos were invisible. So how did this come from a black man?
Yeah, and not only that, when father knew best and patriarchy ruled. Because this black man has bought hook, line, and sinker the idiocy and lunacy of his boss, Donald Trump. I mean, Ben Carson may be a renowned neurosurgeon who separated twins, but he's been incapable of separating himself from his ideological twin, Donald Trump. And not only ideological twin, his paranoid twin. You know, Ben Carson said that Obamacare was the worst thing since slavery. That was, as the philosopher Mike Tyson would say, as ludicrous a statement as one might imagine. So not only is he engaging in hyperbole in such a devastating fashion, his lethal ignorance about immigrants, and then trying to dress it up. Well, immigrants either came here voluntary or involuntary. Of course, coercive immigrants, if you want to play with the language, but then they didn't have a dream, sir, when they came here as slaves, enslaved people. Their dream was to get the heck out of Dodge, so to speak. They wanted to escape the acrimonious conditions in an environment that situated themselves in America, the vitriol, the hatred, the dehumanization, the being treated like chattel, being sold on an open market. That is not an immigrant's dream. And they didn't come here looking at the Statue of Liberty. They came here in the hull of a ship. Dr. Carson is right, but they were not immigrants in that sense. They couldn't choose their destinies. They couldn't choose their names. They didn't have the ability to integrate into American society. They were seen as flotsam and jetsam in the river of life. They were often thrown overboard. Millions died on the passage over here. So there is no easy or facile parallel between immigrant experience in America and Africans who were extricated from their resting place in Africa and brought here in chains. Dr. Carson is lethally ignorant, and the perpetuation of that legacy proves that he's a twin to Donald Trump in more ways than one.
Just in the last minute, a quick summary then from you, Michael Eric Dyson. Here I am as a white man. What do I do and our listeners do to destroy the enduring myths of white supremacy?
Well, you're doing a brilliant job. You have always done a brilliant job. You're one of the great consciences of American radio, and I'm grateful for you. And I think to continue to talk about it, to tell white people that race is not just black or brown or red or yellow, it's white. And when white brothers and sisters think about race, they think of other things than themselves. They're not asked to unmask, unveil, demythologize, look at the fiction of race and whiteness. And if they let go of whiteness, they have something greater to embrace, their humanity. Beyond the myths and fictions of a whiteness that has only served only few white people really well, if they could give that up, they could reclaim a humanity that would forge connections with other people of color around the world, and certainly in this country, to provide a better future for democracy in our own time. So I think that what white brothers and sisters can do is to acknowledge that they're white, to look at the crucible of race in which they have been shaped, and then to ask the question, what can they do to make this life better, and to talk to each other about the vicious consequences of racism and the ways in which the nefarious manifestations of racial ideology are perpetuated in our own time, even by white brothers and sisters who are not the Trump supporters and voters. What about enlightened liberal racism that refuses to acknowledge its complicity in this broader project? One of the things I liked you said earlier, look, Donald Trump is not produced out of whole cloth. He is produced by other ideologies and thoughts that Republicans on the right wing have put forth. So John Boehner, Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Mitch McConnell have all contributed to who Donald Trump is, ideologically and politically speaking. They may find him personally abhorrent, but their ideas are present in him as well. Remember, Frankenstein is the name of the doctor, not the monster. The creation of this edifice of white supremacy, the creation of this monstrous reality that we now identify in Donald Trump, has come back to bite the very people who crafted and created it, and now Donald Trump is a judgment upon whiteness itself. If white brothers and sisters see that, we'll go a long way toward remedying what we've seen.
Well, Michael Eric Dyson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me, my friend.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Eric Dyson, one of America's premier public intellectuals. He occupies the distinguished position of University Professor of Sociology at Georgetown University and is a contributing opinion writer to The New York Times, to The New Republic, and ESPN's Undefeated. Ebony Magazine named him one of the 100 most influential African Americans in the nation, and his latest book just out is Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the latest WikiLeaks data dump.
Increase your pride, telling lies that you're not on your own. Watching faith in prayers will make you see.
Someone took your plans away. So what's all of us? There ain't nobody to spy like us. Hey, don't be afraid of an undercover raid. Let's look beautiful.
Hands down! Come on!
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Alan Paller, the Director of Research at the SANS Institute, a graduate degree-granting institution and the principal cybersecurity training school. Alan directs SANS research programs, including the widely used Internet Storm Center, the Early Warning System for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risks in Cybersecurity Study. Alan has testified several times before both the House and the Senate. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Paller.
Good to be back, Ian.
Well, thank you, Alan. What do you make of this WikiLeaks data dump that came out today, thousands of documents supposedly describing the sophisticated software tools used by the Central Intelligence Agency that are capable of breaking into smartphones, computers, and even smart TVs that are connected to the internet. It's being likened to the data dump from both Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden in scope, 8,000 web pages with 943 attachments and more to come. So how does it strike you?
Well, I've been focusing on it for the last few hours and trying to clarify why there's a difference in opinion. And the answer is that apparently the details of the attacks, meaning the details of the exploitation of the televisions and other tools, phones, were not disclosed for the most part. But it appears that WikiLeaks has the details and says that they will disclose them when they have more clarification on what the CIA is doing with it. And given that that is true, I can't prove any of that other than the WikiLeaks claims to have it and claims to be able to release it. But if it's true, then this is about 60 to 70% of a Snowden. It's terribly damaging to the technical capabilities and effectiveness of the CIA, just as Snowden was to the NSA's activities. The only difference between the two is that the documents that are in this leak do not identify the targets on which the tools have been used. And because of that, it doesn't have the same geopolitical damage that the Snowden documents had. But it's very damaging.
And what you're talking about specifically here, Alan Paller, is that the WikiLeaks release said that the CIA and its allied intelligence services had managed to break into the encryption on popular cell phones and messaging services, Signal, WhatsApp, and Telegram. And also they've been able to hack into Android phones.
So, and also to be able to have a television set that looks like it's off and be a listening device. So there's a lot of craft in this, a lot of work, years and years. I would guess 100 or 200 man years of effort, maybe 10 times that much when you add it all up. So all of that will have to be redone. Much of it is starting right now, I expect.
And I think you're referring there, Alan Paller, to what's the CIA code name, Weeping Angel, which is the use of Samsung smart television sets as effectively as listening devices, where even if the set is turned off, the television is essentially collecting and recording conversations in the room and then sending them on to a CIA server.
We're going to make a techie out of you yet, Ian. Explain that
good
very
luck.
Well.
Good luck. So why is it then that some people are saying, well, you know, these, and I've been trying to do what I could today in terms of doing homework. Some people are saying, well, you know, these documents have been floating around for some time. And first of all, this doesn't look like it has anything to do with the Russian hackers, does it? Or does it? No, I don't know. I mean, it's not a DNC type hack.
I don't have any data on that yet.
Right.
None of us do, I don't
right.
think.
But what about the idea that this stuff's been hanging around or lurking around and on the internet, and its provenance may be, you know, it may have gone through a number of hands, in other words?
That puts it slightly in question, but if you made me do a probability, I would say you're less than 2% in question and 98% likely that these tools are actually the tools that the CIA was using to do exactly what they're described to have done. So the passing around has to do with sharing. You want sharing to happen. The fact that it was shared loosely rather than tightly is carelessness and dangerous carelessness, and I expect that'll get stopped in the future.
But
and what I mean is that it was shared. It wasn't shared with your sister and your brother who work in the bank. It was shared among the people. If the stories are true, it was shared among the people who practice this for the government in classified arenas. But they might not have had a need to know. So it was shared more widely than it probably needed to be.
Well, according to the New York Times, this WikiLeaks document cache, which they call Vault 7, And let me quote the New York Times, has been circulated amongst former U.S. government hackers and contractors in an unauthorized manner, one of whom has provided WikiLeaks with a portion of the archives. So what do you mean?
Right,
that?
That's the same sentence. The contractors are people who work in classified environments who do this kind of work on behalf of intelligence agencies. That's my understanding of who that sharing was with. But one of the people who works for one of those agencies, just like Snowden worked for one of those people who worked for one of those contractors, just as Snowden worked for one of those contractors, decided it was something he wanted to share with WikiLeaks.
What does this tell us then about these documents, about the CIA Center for Cyber Intelligence? Apparently some of the documents, most of the documents, my understanding, they're copies. They don't have any letterhead. They're not first-hand copies. But then apparently there are some that come from the CIA Center for Cyber Intelligence dated 2013 and 2016. So what is this? Is this really, what would these copies be then? And there's supposed to be some redaction that's been done by WikiLeaks.
No clue. The redaction, what the documents are originally, I don't know what file they were in. I don't have access to those files, so I don't have any way to validate them. But the redaction isn't what you're thinking of, which is black lines. What I understand the redaction is that many of the detailed attachments that had the actual tools in it have not yet been released. But they don't seem to be doing that in a thoughtful way. They seem to be doing it as a knife held over the head of or over the neck of the CIA. So, it's almost certain that they will release a lot of those unless they're stopped.
Well, that's not likely, is it? Unless there's an election going on in Ecuador that may determine whether the new government in Ecuador will stop providing Julian Assange with the protection that he's given in the embassy, the Ecuadorian embassy in London. I don't know about the timeline on that, but is there anything that the CIA could do to stop the further release from so-called Vault 7? Because apparently the bulk of this stuff has yet to be released.
I don't know.
Right.
I just said unless it was stopped. I didn't mean,
right. Right.
And I know that it's going to be stopped.
I see. So, but again, this doesn't sound like it's a Russian thing, right? If it came from a U.S. Intelligence contractor. In other words,
There's been nothing posited that the contractor was in any way working for somebody beside himself, but that doesn't mean he wasn't. There's just no one has claimed that the contractor was working on behalf of another country. So.
Right.
I have no reason to believe he was.
Right. Well, I thought that the Cyber Command was largely under the purview of the National Security Agency, that, in fact, there have been some discussions that the NSA is taking on too much because the director of the NSA, Admiral Rogers, is also the head of Cyber Command. So in terms of the U.S. Cyber security and cyber warfare and cyber intelligence, where does this CIA office of the Center for Cyber Intelligence fit into that?
It's an independent agency that developed its own tools. My guess is there was some sharing between the CIA and the NSA of tools, but very light. One tiny silver lining, a pony in all this crap, could be that because they both need to develop new tools very rapidly, there may be more sharing between the two agencies. But they've been competitors in this space for a long time about who comes up with the best tools.
Right, but didn't we also have a big leak coming from the NSA? And again, this was a set of NSA hacking tools that were leaked and stolen in an electronic break-in. By a shadowy group calling itself the Shadow Brokers. So, I mean, what's going on? If it takes these agencies a lot of time, money, and talent to develop these tools, and they just suddenly get leaked willy-nilly, it makes you wonder about cybersecurity.
Well, there are two parts of your willy and nilly.
Right.
So one is what's going on when an insider who's trusted takes documents and leaks them. And that is a battle that has been fought in the press ever since the first of these happened. But the second one you're talking about, which is when someone outside gets in and breaks in, these are all of the work that's being done is being done on commercial systems. We're not using any more military spec computers. And commercial systems have thousands of vulnerabilities in them. And the NSA and the CIA have found some of them, but they're not the only ones looking. So to the extent that they're good at it, other people are also good at it. And these tools have been a godsend to spies, but they're also a danger, because once people can use the internet to get into other people's systems, then people can begin looking to get into our intelligence systems. In fact, the great risk over the next 10 years isn't leaking of data. The great risk is getting into military command and control systems, and more of those systems are built on commercial systems, just as power systems are run on commercial systems and banks are run on commercial systems. So all you're noticing when you say what's going on is, oh, here's an agency that should have had better defense, that wasn't perfect. But given that they weren't able to stop all these attacks, think about what you're saying about organizations with less effective security than the NSA. So we're on the very beginning of a massive change of expectations of safety. And I think one of the first places you're going to see that playing out is in power systems. The keynote presentation by Mike Asante at the RSA conference talked, and he's the world's wizard on how these systems are protected and attacked, said, we've over-automated. We're going to have to put manual checks back in these systems to protect against massive outages. That's a big change in the way people think about cybersecurity.
Right, you're talking about power grids, et cetera, dams, all
exactly.
kinds of critical infrastructure.
Right, and right now, for the last 20 years, we've been automating, but mm-hmm. what Mike said, Mike led the team that went to the Ukraine after their big attack mm-hmm. to understand what was happening to support the Ukrainian government. And he came back and he said that had that attack happened in the United States, the outage would have been much, much worse. Because we're more automated than they are. The only reason it didn't last as long in the Ukraine was that they haven't automated everything. So we've got real tough decisions to make over the next decade. And the other item here is this week's report from the Defense Science Board that said we are not in a position to strike back because we're so automated that our ability to strike back a cyber attack by Russia or China will be disabled by their attack. So all I'm saying is we're reaching a new stage where the attacks are much more damaging. Our knowledge now that we can't just protect them easily, that we're actually going to have to build in stopgap measures, probably manual stopgap measures to protect them, is new knowledge.
But it sounds like if the NSA lost a lot of its cyber tools to this group called the Shadow Brokers, and if this other group, whoever they are, were able to get all this material to WikiLeaks, the material itself is a roadmap for other hackers, giving them the most sophisticated tools. So doesn't this just add to cyber crime, cyber hacking, the whole... It just makes the internet even more of a wild west.
Yes.
So what's the ultimate game here in terms of, it's like with antibiotics, where drugs become, resistant or diseases become resistant to antibiotics, and you can keep having to develop more antibiotics as these antibodies get more and more powerful. And if you cross the line, then you have a global epidemic. Does that same logic apply in cyberspace, that you've got, people like the CIA and the NSA trying to develop these both offensive and defensive tools, but if they keep leaking them out, then the hackers may end up with the advantage over the governments?
No.
Uh-huh.
Almost, but not quite. The hackers have the advantage over the government already, and they have it completely independent of the tools that were lost, because there are thousands of people in Eastern Europe making billions of dollars finding and developing exploits for these commercial tools in order to do commercial hacking, to take over bank accounts, to take over stock brokerage accounts, to do ransomware. So there is a massive market for the development of these tools. The amount that the tools you're talking about are going to enhance that broad capability isn't enough to claim that there's any culpability in the loss of data from the CIA and the NSA. Yes, they will be harmful, but even if they hadn't happened, that epidemic you're talking about is here.
Right, but just in closing, though, Alan Pallon, my understanding is that the FSB, the Russian Intelligence Service, and the SVR use these troll farms and use these cyber criminals on a kind of retainer basis. They're able to go out and steal billions.
Yeah, think of it backwards. Think of it as opportunistic.
Right.
When these guys find something of value, they have a ready market in the government of in Russia.
Right.
As opposed to they get assignments.
Right.
But yes.
But what
the relationship is real.
Right, but what happens to the money? Who subsidizes who? Do the criminals subsidize the FSB, or does the FSB subsidize the criminals, or do they share in the booty?
It's 80% the government subsidizing the criminals, paying the criminals for good stuff. But the government also protects the criminals. Joe Mann did a wonderful book where he documented exactly how the government protects people who do cybercrime from within the Russian Republic. So they pay both in money and in protection in allowing cyber criminal gangs to do their work.
Well, Alan Pallor, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Alan Pallor, who's Director of Research at the SANS Institute, a graduate degree-granting institution in the Principal Cybersecurity Training School. Alan directs SANS research programs, including the widely used Internet Storm Center, the Early Warning System for the Internet, and the annual Greatest Risk in Cybersecurity Study. And Alan's testified several times before the House and the Senate. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an assessment of the American Health Care Act, the House Republican plan to repeal and replace Obamacare. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jonathan Oberlander, who's a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science. A leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform, he's the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the three-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, Second Edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Oberlander.
Thanks so much for having me.
And finally, the repeal and replace Republican bill to repeal Obamacare has emerged, and it looks like it's in more trouble with the Republicans than anything else. Conservatives, Republicans saying it doesn't go far enough, and other Republicans who are concerned about the evisceration of Medicaid are balking at it as well. So what's your overall take on it?
Well, I think you're right. I think it is going to have a narrow path through Congress, and it's not going to be an easy one. On the one hand, you have conservatives in the Republican caucus, which is already conservative, but folks like Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky saying this is Obamacare light and they cannot vote for it. It's too much federal involvement, too much entitlement, too much federal spending. And then you do have those senators, Republican senators from states like Ohio, like Colorado, like Alaska, that have expanded Medicaid. They're not eager to lose federal money for Medicaid expansion. And so it's going to be very difficult to navigate this bill through the House and especially the Senate, where Republicans have a majority only of 52.
So in general, though, what's your impression of what the Republicans are calling? I guess Paul Ryan is the one. He's sort of taking responsibility for this, whether he likes it or not. It's called the American Health Care Act, and it's got to get through two complementary bills going through Energy and Commerce Committee and the Ways and Means.
It is a complex combination. In part, it retains many things that the Affordable Care Act does. So most of the insurance market rules in the Affordable Care Act that protect people with pre-existing conditions ensure that kids can stay on their parents' health plans to age 26, those sorts of things. They're actually retained in the Republican bill. It also does not eliminate the health insurance exchanges or health insurance marketplaces that were set up by the Affordable Care Act where people can go and buy coverage. And it also retains some level of subsidy, premium subsidy, that will help people buy coverage. So there are a lot of things in there, and much more than I mentioned, that are kept from the Affordable Care Act. On the other hand, it makes some changes, and I really think the bill would be more accurately called the Less Affordable Care Act, because if you look at two things it does in particular, one is that it really rolls back projected federal spending on Medicaid. This is the program that helps tens of millions of low-income Americans afford medical care, and the Republican bill would change federal spending. It would end its current budgetary status as an entitlement and put a cap on it. And it would also, quite importantly, dramatically reduce federal funding to states that have expanded Medicaid after 2020. If you take that and then you look at how they've changed the tax credits, really what's happened with the tax credits to help the uninsured purchase health insurance, in the Republican plan, the credits are better for people who make over $40,000, but they're substantially worse for most people who make under $20,000. And that's where most of the uninsured are. And finally, the legislation also proposes to cancel virtually all of the Affordable Care Act's taxes. And let's not forget the Affordable Care Act was quite a redistributive law, and that the expansion of health insurance access was paid for from two sources. One is savings in Medicare, which the Republicans keep, and the other one is higher taxes on affluent Americans. And so it gets rid of that. This is really a bill in key respects that is reverse Robin Hood, that is cutting taxes for the wealthy while at the same time reducing access to health insurance for low-income Americans.
Well, in terms of an attitude, because when you cut Medicaid for the poorest people, it's pretty clear that what the consequences will be there. And then, as you just pointed out, Jonathan Oberlander, that the Affordable Care Act had taxes on the wealthiest Americans, and they are being taken off. But in terms of a kind of mindset, and I wonder how pervasive this is, House Oversight Committee Chairman Jason Chaffetz told CNN in regard to Medicaid and poor people, he quote, "And so maybe rather than getting that new iPhone that they just love and they want to spend hundreds of dollars on, maybe they should invest in their own health care." It feels and sounds incredibly callous. And of course, I mean, you know, you break your leg, it costs $100,000, and it's an awful lot of iPhones.
It sounds callous because it is. There are millions of Americans who most of whom are working Americans who don't have health insurance and cannot afford coverage. There are tens of millions of Americans who do have health insurance and can't afford their bills because of high deductibles and other forms of cost sharing. And to sort of trivialize the kind of struggles that working Americans have paying for medical care by comparing it to an iPhone for a couple hundred dollars, I would suggest that the congressman perhaps spend a day in a hospital and see what Americans actually pay who go through the system. So I do think, unfortunately, it tells you a little bit about the disregard here for people's concerns. Let's not forget that members of Congress have long had subsidized health insurance, and they seem to favor that subsidy for themselves and yet not for others.
So do you think that the town hall meetings, and of course a lot of Republican congressmen and some senators have avoided doing them anymore, by and large, they seem to be focused on the concern about losing their health insurance. It is so fundamental to most Americans. And my understanding is another part of this new Republican plan removes the responsibility on the part of big corporations to provide their employees with health care.
That's right. It eliminates the penalty that larger employers pay under the Affordable Care Act. And I think those town hall meetings you cited are, it's a bit like we're in Alice in Wonderland or a parallel universe, because for, generations, Democratic policymakers struggled with how do you do health care reform amidst a public that doesn't like the system but is happy with their own arrangements. How do you get it through with all these stakeholders that have tremendous interests in play? How do you get healthcare reform through when you have a consensus there's a problem and not a solution? Now Republicans are trying their hand at this, and they're running into exactly the same thing. And, of course, in these town hall meetings ran into very much the same resistance that Democrats encountered 7 years ago. And one of the interesting phenomena about Obamacare is it never has been particularly popular. You can make the case that it is a success in terms of a lot of policy goals. It has substantially reduced the uninsured population in this country. It's made health insurance much more affordable, even with all the problems it's had. And yet it's been a political failure. And you can see that when you look at the polls, and over the past 7 years, it really has never been popular. And yet, in these past couple months, just like a critically acclaimed television show that people don't watch, and when you announce it's going to be canceled, its ratings go up, Obamacare is having its same near-death experience. And so the polling on it is actually substantially higher than it was a few months ago. And that makes it politically more difficult for Republicans and underscores a real challenge they have in undoing a law that is gaining adherence.
And in terms of the senators, Republican senators that are concerned about cuts to the expansion of Medicaid, who said that they on Monday that they won't vote for a bill that takes away federal money for that expansion. And that's Republican Senator Rob Portman of Ohio, Shelley Moore Caputo of West Virginia, Cory Gardner of Colorado, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. So that's enough to kill it in the Senate, isn't it? And I'm curious to know what you think, Jonathan Oberlander, of that's the opposite in terms of the attitude of Jason Chavez, who has that sort of Marie Antoinette attitude, let them eat cake. These senators do seem to have a conscience.
Right. So, and it's easier to have a conscience when your state's getting a lot of money. The fact is that states have a lot of money on the line in these Medicaid expansions. And I think it is important to hear the voices of those Republican senators who've said, we don't want health care taken away from our citizens. And at the same time, you have the right flank, Jason Chaffetz and Rand Paul and others in the Freedom Caucus, and who think this really has gone too far. So I think let's not forget that Paul Ryan is Speaker of the House, not of the Senate. He's not Majority Leader of the Senate. And this bill came from the House leadership. They've been talking to the White House about it, but how much support it has in the Senate is really unclear. And there's a rich irony, which is Republicans have criticized Democrats in the Obama administration for, quote-unquote, rushing through health reform in 2009 and 10, which was a year-long debate, actually, before the final legislation passed. They're talking about voting on in the House in two key committees in the next couple weeks on this bill before we even have the estimates from the Congressional Budget Office on how much this will cost, which is important because it's not at all clear that the math adds up in this bill. And it is highly likely that they will project that it will result in many fewer Americans having insurance coverage. And yet Congress is now rushing with a vote. So let's say tables have turned since 2010.
But is that cynical? In other words, you push it through without the fine print, and then once it's passed, then all the celebrations take place, and then the people find out that it's actually there's few of them are covered.
Well, one person's cynicism is another person's clever legislative strategy, but I'm not sure, again, that it's going to go through the Senate, which is slower and structured differently than the House. And I don't know that it'll go through the Senate at quite the same speed. And I think some conservatives are going to have real questions about what the impact is on federal spending. The Congressional Budget Office has said that repealing Obamacare will increase the deficit. And the question is, what does this law do? How does it come out at the end of the day with all the parts that it's kept and some of the new parts that it's put in?
But can they get it into the Senate in such a way that it will be within the reconciliation rules guidelines? In other words, it will not require 60 votes as normally to overcome a Democratic filibuster.
Much of it they can. The ultimate ruling on that would be made by the Senate parliamentarian. I'm not sure 100% of what they proposed is going to make it through reconciliation and that special process, where, as you say, you just need a simple majority. But again, with only 52 seats, Republican seats in the Senate, they can't afford to lose the four senators worried about Medicaid expansion and Rand Paul and other conservatives. So it remains to be seen if they can assemble even the 50 that they need for that kind of bill.
So where does this, do you think, you've got, as you've made it clear, you've got Rand Paul and others like Justin Amash in the House calling it Obamacare Lite and Obamacare 2.0, et cetera, and dismissing it out of hand, the Freedom Caucus, of course, as well, the usual suspects, the Club for Growth and the Koch brothers are dead against it. But and on the other side, you've got on the political left of the Democratic Party, there's always this sense that they should have at least had the public option and at least entertained the possibility of a single payer. Is that inevitable, or is that just something you simply cannot get through because of the power of insurance companies? Because every other advanced democracy has single payer because it's actually incredibly logical and much less expensive because, in effect, insurance companies are the unnecessary middleman between the patient and the healthcare provider. They don't bring anything to the table except their overhead and expenses, which are passed on. And I've never understood why that argument can't be made in the simplest terms, in the economic terms, as opposed to falling a trap to this ideological idea that it's socialism.
Well, we, of course, have a modified single-payer program, which is our own Medicare program in this country, although we often leave that out of the discussion. I think that if you look around, other rich democracies, they don't all have single-payer in the sense of one government program. What they all have are arrangements that assure universal or virtually universal health care. And there's variation between a system like the British National Health Service, which would be like our VA, or the Canadian system, which in each province would be like our own Medicare program, and in fact is called Medicare up in Canada as well, to the systems in continental Europe and places like Germany or the Netherlands, where they have multiple insurance companies, non-governmental, that are extraordinarily regulated and historically were largely non-for-profit. So there is variation abroad. There's no country that has as many people uninsured as the U.S., and the U.S. is the only rich democracy without a system of universal coverage. Those arguments, those economic arguments, have been made. The problem is a dollar of spending on health care is a dollar of income to the industry. And so when you make an argument that single payer would save you money to the healthcare industry, that means it would cost them income. Those sorts of systems have also been difficult in the U.S. because of our political institutions and greater fear of government. But there is a great irony I want to point out about the Affordable Care Act. Obamacare, in many ways, is actually a Republican health plan. It is, after all, 95% the same as what Massachusetts did under then-governor, Republican governor Mitt Romney. It's quite similar in many respects to a Republican health plan, which was a major alternative in the 1990s, and also similar in many respects to what Richard Nixon proposed as president. So the irony is Republicans right now have moved so far to the right that they're busy repealing their own health plan. And that's why when you look at the replacement, it has certain elements that resemble Obamacare. Well, it has to, because Obamacare actually is, in some respects, or was, a Republican health plan.
Well, just in closing, you mentioned how the provinces in Canada have their own health care plans. Would it be possible then, let's assume, for example, that Donald Trump survives, there's some question about his capabilities and his mental state, et cetera, in terms of this erratic presidency we're watching with absolute dismay. If the Pences and the Ryans are able to enact their agenda, lots of states like California almost sort of certainly will think of themselves as almost like the California Republic. And there's already talk about that in Sacramento, about the idea that why don't we in California have our own health care plan. Is that feasible if the government goes off the rails and goes far to the right, that some states, the particularly ones like California that are the world's sixth biggest economy, could they have their own health care?
Well, I used to live in Berkeley, so I'm very familiar with the notion that California is its own republic. So this country is divided, and you saw it in the election, and you've seen it since. And there is, I think, a chance that the blue states, the liberal governed states, places like California and Oregon and Washington State, and then some of the states in the upper Northeast, that some of those states will react to what's going on in Washington by wanting to go their own way. And essentially the mirror of Republican-led state resistance to the Affordable Care Act, you could see Democratic resistance to any Republican health reform plan that's passed, and a real desire to do something on their own. There's been talk about states doing this for decades. The problem is a financial one. And particularly for a state as large as California, the question becomes, can that state really put it together financially enough to make its own health plan work? But if a Republican plan like the one that's been proposed goes through, then I think you are likely to hear more liberal-leaning states talking about doing their own thing in healthcare. And that divide in the United States between those who have access to health insurance and those who do not, that divide between states that provide some of the poorest of their citizens with access to health insurance and those who do not, those divisions will grow.
Well, Jonathan Oberlander, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Oberlander, who's a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science, a leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform. He's the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the three-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, Second Edition. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.